Alright, let's begin then. Let us bring our palms together to make our utmost veneration to the supremely enlightened one, the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one. He who is the epitome of wisdom and the fount of compassion. Let us remind ourselves as we do this, this is not a mere mark of our veneration, but also an acknowledgement that the Buddha represents the truth, the Dhamma, the path, and the Sangha, the practice, that we must all take each by ourselves to embark on this journey to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. We are here to support one another, but the walk is alone. This is a moment to reflect upon that and to acknowledge that, and to remind ourselves to be steadfast on this journey. Let us also take a moment to observe the precepts such that they may guide us on this noble path, keep us from committing offenses and sins that derail us from the path to Nibbana. Let us also invite the countless sentient beings in the 10,000 world systems and within earshot of this sermon. May they be amongst us and witness this meritorious deed as it unfolds. And if there are among them those who are lacking in merit, and as a result of which they are today not born in the blissful plane, may they witness this meritorious deed and rejoice in it and be born in the blissful plane. And for all sentient beings who are in the blissful plane, such as yourselves, may this be an opportunity to listen to the teachings of the great masters, to learn to understand and comprehend the same truths that they once did, such that we can enjoy and achieve and attain the ultimate fruits of Nibbana just as they once did. So with that in mind, let us make a start to today's proceedings by chanting the Namaskara. And for that, please repeat all together and with me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Shall we earn for ourselves some quick merits before we begin? You know the drill now. Phones, silent, bottles, away from legs length, coughs, coughed, sneezes, sneezed. So if you're all ready, we can begin then. You might find that these days, that sixth precept that you observe is a little bit difficult to put into practice, especially when you're queuing for your fuel at the sheds. No queues? No queues now? No? What happened? Now there's no petrol now. QR codes. Okay. So for now you're going with us. So if you don't have a QR code, then you don't go. Okay. There's a quota. Okay. Are you assured fuel if you have a QR code? Okay. So they have stocks. So you never have to turn back without fuel. If you had the quota, then they give you, yeah? Lucky you. I don't have a QR code. I don't even have a QR code. But there are reports from people saying that how others come and they fuel their, like they take lots of fuel into their, what they call them, tanks and so on. And people are annoyed about that, and a lot of aggression and agitation. Reports, I don't know, people tell me. The only time we stop at a shed is on the way back to Colombo, sorry, on the way back to Ingiriya, from Rajagiriya. That's the only time I have to pull up at a shed, but other times I only get reports from what people tell me. So perhaps it's on social media, maybe there are reports like that, maybe on the news, about people spotting injustice and how it's unfair that others get more than their due quota. And then people getting annoyed about that, almost on the verge of fights, arguments, brawls, altercations and all sorts. So then sabba sattesu metta sagatin, that goes out the window. So these are those testing times. I will be careful. These, you know, precepts are not just for, like a puppy is not just for Christmas. Precepts are not just for Sundays. This is a solemn oath that you take. It is the very first thing that the Buddha advised we must do if we are to get to Nibbana. Sabba papassa akarana. When you observe the precepts, that is the promise that you make to yourself, not to the monk. It's not to me that you make this promise. Saminas, I promise, I will not steal, I will not lie, I will not take another's life. I make a promise to you. No, don't make promises to me. I don't trust you. Don't make promises to me. Because I know you're good when I'm here. In our teacher's presence, we are always good. In our parents' presence, we are always good. But the true test of our goodness is when there's no one else around, when we are alone, or when we feel that there's no one else to judge us. That's when we are really put to the test. So from time to time you will have these periods, ladies and gentlemen, how things will be scarce. Sometimes maybe the supermarkets at some point, you know, they'll be scarce, some items will be scarce, and then there'll be queues, and then there'll be competition. And then your instinct will tell you, well, if there's a competition, I must be there first. And then you will look for fairness. This is usually what our instinct will tell us. Let's come up with a fair system. Fairness is something we always demand. That's why we have a government. We expect a government to install a fair system, to introduce and establish a fair system, right? So there will be times where we complain how things are unfair, unjust. This is why we have a legal system. A legal system is a convention that we have all come together. No one consulted me, but apparently that's how it's done. So they come together, people who represent us. They're supposed to represent us, and they come up with a system. And that is how the countries run from then on. So each country has one like that, and the whole world is run according to that. So when you feel that that's not fair, usually that will result in, when the next election comes along, you will try and throw the people out who you don't like, because you feel that they were not supportive of your goals and ambitions, and you will try and elect someone who you feel is more aligned to your goals and your ambitions. But if you understand how karma and vipaka works, everything's fair in this game. You have never been treated unfairly. Never. None of us has ever been treated unfairly. Every mock, every ridicule, every praise, every blame, every gift, every theft, all of these things have always been fair. It's about time that we accept that. If you are shouted at, if you are attacked, if you are hit, you make me stop the sermon. It's not the person who walks into the room that does that. You do that. That's not the interruption. You are the interruption. Why? Because you're looking that way. So what you're telling me is, Swami Nazar, shut up for a moment. Like, you are no longer interesting. Let's see what's going on there. So then I have to stop. These are curious minds. Catch it when it happens. This is part of your practice, ladies and gentlemen. If you are not mindful here on a Sunday morning, yes, if on a Sunday morning you have Swami Nuhansa here and you are not mindful, what can be said about the rest of the time? Think. See, all these sermons I've been doing, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, there's nothing of intrinsic value in them. And yet, when someone opens the door, you're all looking that way. Who is that? What is that sound? Is it Santa? These are those. Mindfulness is something we all need to practice, ladies and gentlemen. Mindfulness is not something you practice when you close your eyes and sit down in your meditative posture. Because how often can you do that? Mindfulness is what you need to be while you're driving your car. Mindfulness is what you need to be while you're cooking in your kitchen, talking to your children, at the workplace, doing your reports, in a meeting. You've got to be mindful all of the time. What if you die at that time and you're not mindful? If you die at a time where you are curious about a certain sight, sound, smell, taste or touch, you think, well, that must be of value, so I need to pay attention to that. I want to see what that is. I want to hear what that is. I want to smell what that is or taste what that is. I want to feel what that is. If you die at that moment, I can guarantee that you will be born again. Why? Because what does your mind say? That these things are priceless, they're valuable. I want them, I need them. Well, if you need them, then you will have to keep coming back for them. So it's not easy. Not because the Dhamma is difficult. It's not easy because of our habits. But this is a practice that we have to be, this is a practice you have to be mindful of. And mindfulness is a habit that we must all practice. It is something that I had to practice myself. When I'm speaking with someone, if someone else walks in from the other side of the room or from behind me, and let's say the person who's talking to me just move their head to a side and talk to the other person, what is the automatic habit? To turn around and see who it is, right? I had to practice to break out of that. Remind myself, why? Why should I turn? Because they're not having a conversation with me. My conversation is with the person I'm just speaking with. So why should I turn my head around to see who it is that this person is now having a conversation with? If I'm invited to do so, fair enough. But if not, I'm not part of the conversation. So why do I need to know that? The need to know is the reason we are here. In existence, in samsara, the need to know. That is the last one of the defilements to be removed. The need to know. So that's not me telling you off. Just reminding you that these are those moments that tests how mindful you are. This is life. Here, outside, that's life. We must live always prepared to die. Right? Live always prepared to die. Because death does not come knocking on your door with prior notice. Death doesn't say, I'll come next Monday. Be ready. No. There is no guarantee that we will all leave this room alive. You know, we are nothing but just a drop of dew on the edge of a blade of grass. That's it. At any moment, this could be our last. So this is what I meant about constant application. Application of the Dhamma is your only refuge. Listening to the Dhamma helps you understand what the Dhamma is. But then the application of the Dhamma is what cleanses your mind from defilements. That's why Sunday mornings is not the only thing that you need to do. Sunday mornings is the start of what you need to do. But the rest of the week, that's what really puts you through the washing machine. That's so important. That's why I chose this life as a monastic. Because I needed constant noble association to guide me and to right me, to correct me every time I make a wrong step. But not everyone is privileged to have that. In a lay life, it's not something you can have. That's why you need to put in extra effort. If I put in one, you need to put in 10. But how can we? We are only lay. How can we? Well, that's the thing. What you need to do is difficult to do. But that's no reason to give up. It's just a reason to be even more diligent with your practice. Remember, I'm not here because I want to do a sermon on a Sunday morning. You're not here because you've got nothing better to do on a Sunday morning. We are both here with absolute purpose, right? My victory is your salvation. Not that we have done a talk, it goes on YouTube, and then there's a playlist. So many talks done over the last however many years, and I've got a fan base, I've got a number of viewers. Even if I come top in the YouTube hit playlists or YouTube view counts, what's the point? It's not something that I've never done before. I've done that plenty times before. Not in this life, previous lives. Our objective is to end this game. And because you are so fervent about it, and so determined to do that, I'm here to work with you to do it. Yeah? So do try to be mindful at all times. Now someone's phone will go off in a moment. See, I can predict the future now. Despite the reminders, it will happen. It's just such a natural thing, right? Someone's phone will go off. And what will be your instinct? Instinctive reaction is to do what? Turn around, see whose phone, whose phone, whose phone. If it's not your phone, why does it matter whose phone it is? Think about this. If it's not your phone, why does it matter whose phone it is? Are you the one who's going to be turning that off? Then it shouldn't matter, right? But we always have this question in our minds, who? This is the very question the Buddha tried to put a stop to. Who? We start with, who am I? That's the problem. We have this question, who am I? And then who are you? Who is he? Who is she? Who are they? Who are we? This who question is fundamentally flawed. But when someone's phone goes off, you want to know? Who? And I've spent the whole sermon talking about the fact that there is no who. Just Just before we do the Punya Anumodana, phone goes off. Whose phone? These are those habitual traits that we have. It's fine, we can come out of all this because I was there myself. Be mindful. Mindfulness is a practice. It's not just a precept, it's a practice. But you see, you can't do mindfulness unless you are at right view. Without sammāditti, you can't have sammāsati. Sammāsati is to be mindful, right mindfulness. But you can't have right mindfulness unless you have sammāditti. Now, if you're smart enough, you can work out why. I've just explained to you. I gave you the explanation first and now I'm giving you the theory, the doctrine. Sammāsati, right mindfulness, is the prevailing, the default state of your mind that is aware that no sight, sound, smell, taste or touch is of any essence. They're all just manifestations. If they're mere manifestations and you are in that mindset, then there's no need to be curious about any of it. Right? So that can only come once you have understood the truth, right? Which is sammāditti. So to have sammāditti is always a precursor to having sammāsati. So this is why we spend time talking about what sammāditti is, what is right view. Because there's no point in me saying, don't do this, don't do that. We've had that plenty of times. Don't do this, don't do that. Don't get angry. How many times have you heard that? You know, if you're... Sometimes even the doctor tells you that, right? Oh, looking at your reports, you should probably try not to be angry. Just control your temper. As if you do it voluntarily. Yeah, like I've got nothing better to do, doctor, so I just get angry when I like to, you know. Duh. No one wants to get angry, but it just happens. So the doctor prescribes, don't get angry. But where's the pill? Where's the pill? See? Super pill. So the doctor says, don't get angry, where's the pill? The doctor says, when there's a sound, don't turn your head looking around, where it came from, whose it is. But the pill? That's what I'm saying, there's no point saying don't, unless you treat the root causes. I know you don't like to feel guilt, but there's no point in me just prescribing don't feel guilt. What's the point? You feel it anyway, because it's not you who's feeling it, it just happens. Do you like feeling scared? When you have to step out in the porch at night, there's a noise coming from the outside. It's all black, dark, there's power cut as well, and there's a noise coming from the outside. You're the one who has to now step outside. If your husband's home, then great. But if he's not home, then you have to do it. Or if he's too lazy, he says, why is it always me? Why can't you go do it once in a while? Then you have to go do it, right? At that time, how do you feel? Scared, right? So the doctor says, looking at your heart, they've done some scans, right? You must not take too much pressure. That your heart can't bear so much pressure, so you had better not, you know, give yourself these frights and sudden jerks and things like that. Be gentle on yourself, says the doctor. Where's the pill? And then as you open the door, just to see if everything's okay, the cat jumps at you. Gives you the fright of your life. How do you stop that? Wasn't an intruder, wasn't a ghost, wasn't anything like that. It was just the cat. Nothing to be scared of, because the moment you... And you say that you, that happens after you realize that it's a cat, but then it's too late. So if you're a heart patient, as you reach 120, you will start to be. If you're a heart patient, right, the last thing you should get is scared. Number two, angry. These are the two things that you must try and avoid at all costs. Scared and angry. Okay, tell me how you do that then. So you don't watch horror films because it's not good to be scared. Okay, you can try and do that. But what if someone scares you? What if that happens? You're just walking around the corner and your little one thinks that he just wants to prank you. I go, boo. Just a little one. 6-year-old. Scare you. And then? See, how can the doctor stop that from happening? But it's possible. It's possible through the Dhamma. Scare, to be scared is a response to a threat you feel to yourself. That is a response that you have. It's an internal response. When you feel yourself is threatened, being scared comes naturally. So for as long as you feel a sense of self, you will always feel scared. When you have an exam coming up, again, scared. Worried. The same can be said about anger. Often, you know, when you have heart patients, people say don't, you know, be very careful with them. Don't do things that will make them angry. Don't annoy them. Just, you know, be very kind and very soft and gentle with them. Don't say things that might give them a shock. Okay, where's the pill for that? Now you just have to live life very carefully. But when you're young, it's okay because your heart can take it. But that's not the answer, is it? It's not the solution. This is where the Dhamma comes in, ladies and gentlemen. But the Dhamma alone can't do it unless you're mindful. A Rahatan Vahanse is not someone who needs to be mindful because their default state of mind is now in line with the Dhamma. That is parallel to the Dhamma. It is the Dhamma, basically. The Dhamma internalized. That's the Rahatan Vahanse. Those who are training to be Arahants, like you and myself, we must be mindful. When we are mindful, we see the world through the lens of Dhamma. When we are not, we see the world in a very mundane sense. And all these two-dimensional things come in, become realities. When we are not mindful, we see others, we see ourselves, we see things, we see objects. I don't mean physically, right? I'm talking mentally. We see these objects and we feel that we have interactions with each other. Then we see families, we see friends, we see relations, we see mothers, fathers. These are conventional realities that become absolute realities. But they're mere conventions. Mindfulness is to be in a state of mind where you understand a conventional reality as a mere conventional reality and not elevate it to an absolute reality. For that, mindfulness is absolutely essential. Therefore, as good Buddhists, this is not about a religion. Buddhism is a science. As good scientists then, scientists of the mind, it is imperative that you practice this mindfulness. So when we go to the Valley Malu, when you're at the monastery and we do these meditation programs, we teach you to be mindful. Mindful not just about a sound. So it's not like I ring a bell and I ask you to keep your attention to that. This is not single-pointedness. It's not keeping your mind on one thing. It's keeping your mind in the truth, which are two different things. Let me give you a simple example. See, I have with me a pen. This pen is precious to me. My father gave it to me. Don't you have things like that of sentimental value? Family heirlooms and things like that? Your grandmother's ring? Your grandfather's briefcase? Your great-grandfather's walking stick? I'm sure you must all have something like that, one thing or the other. Right? So this pen is very precious to me, my father gave it to me. On the day of my ordination, he said, "Putta, now I see that you don't need much of what I have used, what I had in mind to offer you, or to pass on to you, so I'll give it to your younger brother, but I will give you this pen." He said, "Use it wisely." So this pen is precious to me. Well, it wasn't really this pen, because the pen that he gave to me, I used for a while, and then the cap broke. The cap broke. So because the cap broke, I got myself a new cap. It wasn't just the cap that broke. A few months before that, the nib broke. So I replaced the nib. About a year before that, I mean, it's been 10 years since he gave me that pen. You can see it still looks brand new, right? Right? So a year after he gave me the pen, I used it. The pen ran out of ink. So I replaced the tube. And then one day I dropped this. And when I dropped it, the barrel broke. This plastic bit, so I replaced that. So I just replaced all of those pieces, and now I still use the pen that my father gave me. So this pen is very close to my heart. I mean, all I had to do was just replace a few parts, that's all. But other than that, it's fine. Writes very well. Still writes. And after 10 long years, it still writes just fine. I mean, every once in a while, I just have to replace the tube, because when the ink runs out, put a new one. Because I don't want to throw the pen away, because it's the pen that my father gave me. So when the pen runs out, what you might normally do is what? Throw it and get a new one, right? I wouldn't do that, not with this pen. Other pens I don't mind, but not this pen, because this is the pen my father gave me. I mean, it's the same pen, it's just that I have replaced a few of the parts, practically all of the parts. So any other object here, I'm quite happy and all right for you to take with you. If you want, you can ask for it. This and even this. Provided you will use it, take it. But this pen? No. Sorry, can't give you that. The parts that broke, I can give them to you. That's okay. I have the broken parts here. These were the broken parts. So these parts you can take, it's fine. Because they're broken. I have no use for them anymore. But this one, the good one, the one that I replaced the parts and now it works just fine. Yeah? This is the pen my father gave. That one I'm not going to give to anyone. Sorry, I'm attached to this. So my all my worldly possessions are my two robes, or my three robes, my alms bowl and my pen. Anything else you can take, not this one. Why are you all laughing? What's so funny? Here are the parts that broke and I don't want them anymore, it's broken, it's trash. You can come and take it if you want. Not this one though. Why are you laughing about it? What's so funny? I'm talking about something very sensitive to my heart. It's very close to my heart. This is a very sensitive matter. Why are you laughing about it? Don't make a joke of everything. What do you find funny? Huh? This is not the pen? Out, dare you. Out. How dare you say that this is not the pen my father gave? This is the pen that my father gave me. Yes, I've had to replace a few parts over the years, but it's still the pen that my father gave me. There's nothing wrong with it. And, you know, it's just as new. It looks just like when he gave it to me all those years ago. I have maintained it. Spick and span, right? It's perfect. What's the problem? What's the problem? See, you laugh at me, but your car? When you buy your car, and then over time you have to replace parts. You take it to the garage, you have an accident, you know, some parts just wear out and then you have to replace those parts. And you still say it's your car, right? The car you bought. And you have a very sentimental bond with it. So that's okay. This is not okay. My pen is not okay. What is it that still keeps telling us that this is the pen that my father gave me? That is what we call jati. That's why you feel that this is the same pen. You understand what I'm talking about? This is why you feel that this is the same pen. This is why that I feel that it's the same pen. You can substitute this with any object, practically. Once we talked about Appuhami's Udal at the monastery in one of the Singhala sermons. Appuhami had a mamati, which had a blade and a handle. And then he gave it to his son. And over the years, he replaced. At one point, he replaced the handle, the blade. And then later, he replaced the handle. And he still says that this is the mamati that my father gave me. Is that true? But what is it that tells us? What is this instinctive feeling that tells us, no, this is the pen that my father gave me? That is jati, ladies and gentlemen. Logic tells you that it's not. Logic defies your instinct. The arahant does not feel this way. The way that you feel right now, the story that I just related to you, that this is the pen that my father gave me, the arahant does not feel that way. See, I told you, didn't I, that these are the broken parts. You can take them if you want. If anything, those are the parts that my father gave me. But now they're the broken parts. You can... I don't want them anymore. I've just discarded them. But this pen, none of it has any of the parts that my father handed over to me. Each and every part of this is new. It's not the same. But see how we are fooled by similarity. We think similarity is the same as sameness. This is because of jati. This happens in every area of our lives. Take your child for example. When your child was born, how big were they? You could carry them in one hand, right? You look at your child today and you still say that is the same child that was born 16 years ago. Hardly any of what the child was when they were born is now there with this child. All parts, almost virtually all parts have been replaced. Virtually all cells have been replaced. Why do you still say it's the same child? See, people build a house, after a while they knock it down, and they build again. And they say, this is still my house. And so they've made some changes. To what? To my house. So that's what's happened here, right? I've made a few changes to the pen that my father gave me. With a few changes, it's still the pen that my father gave me. Is that so? But why do we feel that way? Don't you feel that way? Just imagine, you know, this is my pen, the pen that my father gave me, but if your father, if your mother had given you such an object, you would still feel the same. If one part of it broke, you would simply replace it and continue using it. If another part broke, you would replace it and then continue using it. Imagine it was some kind of ornament. Say it was a watch or something, right? And then the watch fell and broke. So you take it to the repair shop. And they say, right, we have to repair the springs, we have to replace the glass, we have to replace the dials, we have to replace this, that and the other. And they replace pretty much all of it. And then they say they've repaired it, and then they say, you can now come and collect it. As you go into the shop, the repair shop, you see there's a watch that has now, they said, repaired. You pay the bill and you take it home. You say, what's all that on the other side? Oh, those are all the broken parts. Looking at that, still you walk away with this one saying, that's my watch. That's the watch that my grandfather gave me. You look at all those parts that have just been discarded, removed from the damage. But you still feel that this is the watch that my grandfather gave me. It's time we unveiled the truth behind all this, very soon. Because of this, you experience a past. See, you see a past. You say, in the past, this was as new. This was new, and then it broke, and then I fixed it. See, the story that you tell yourself, when my father gave this to me, this was new, and then it broke, right? And then I fixed it. See, this is on a story, it's on a timeline. But the Buddha says that time is merely an illusion. We don't agree with that. Your instinct doesn't agree with that. Your instinct says, how can time be an illusion? Time is the very thing that keeps me connected to everything and everyone in this world. Because in your world, there is something static. And with reference to that something that is static, everything else changes. What is that static thing? That's not dynamic. Your sense of self. In some religions they call it Atma. This they claim to be static. This is there, it's fixed. With reference to that, in relation to that, all other things change. This is what people back then went and asked the Buddha, who is that is static? Who is it that is static? What is it that is static? And the Buddha always replied, you're asking the wrong question. You want me to answer the question, who it is that is static? Who it is that is fixed? Who is this entity? And the Buddha says, wrong question. You must not be asking me who it is that is static, but ask me instead, why is it that you feel that there is such a thing that is static? Where does that come from? Where does that feeling come from? And then he went on to describe and explain the doctrine, which is what I'm going to explain to you now. Remember, the reason I'm going to explain this to you is because you still think that this is my father's pen. If you didn't feel that way, I wouldn't have to give you this discourse. But because you agreed with what I said earlier, this is the pen that my father gave. Right? And I said, I just replaced a few parts. And it's now fine, it writes just as well. And you're all going, yeah, good for you, Swami. No answer. Right? Does it not remind you of your father all the time? It must be very precious to him. Because you agree with all those things I said, you need this discourse. Logically, you realize or you understand that that doesn't make much sense. How can that make sense? Because you have just replaced all of the parts. But instinctively, your mind says another story. Now these two things are at odds with each other. One thing makes logical sense. The other thing is your mind. And it doesn't agree with logic. That's because your mind is in another dimension. Your mind has another view of the world. That view is wrong view. Therefore, we need to talk about right view, sammaditti. This is micchaditti. And the Buddha says, micchaditti samadana satta gacchanti duggatin. What the Buddha means by that is, one who has subscribed or believes in micchaditti is one who ends up in the duggati. Not sugati, duggati. You are now in the sugati. So we need to come out of this micchaditti and step into sammaditti. Do you understand why sammaditti is important? Do you understand why the rest of this talk is going to be important? Otherwise we're just giving a talk. You're listening to some dhamma and you walk away. There's no point in doing that. You need to understand that this is the pill for the problems that we talked about earlier. Asked, where's the pill? Where's the pill the doctor gives? No pill. For anger, where's the pill? For jealousy, where's the pill? For being scared, where's this pill? Where's the pill? For guilt, where's the pill? This is the pill. So let's talk about the pill then. So as we talk about this, ladies and gentlemen, as we talk about this, your merits and your attention are the two things that will help you understand this. So pay complete attention. Imagine there's no one else in this room right now, just you and I. And give it to you 100%. All those merits that you have been doing throughout the past week and from before, this is the fruit. This is the reward for that. If you understand this and if this internalizes, you need not come back here again either. Because from there on you can be your own teacher. Let's talk about how the mind works. You know that you have a mind. You know you have a mind. Because you're able to sense the world around you. If these senses were to cease, you would not be aware of your existence. And those senses are sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. These we call the five senses. It is because of these five senses and the sensations that you have, you can add another one. Just call it thoughts. Thoughts that you have even when you have, you know, you imagine the past, you imagine the future. You have, you know, your own imagination, creative imagination. So these are the five or the six senses that assure you that you are alive and you are in existence. It is the eye that brings in stimuli through this sense door, the ear that does this part, the nose that does this, the tongue, the body, and the mind. So the mind itself can generate its own thoughts. We call them rupa, these things. This is called rupa rupa. There's a bit of an echo on this microphone. Can someone do something about it? This is called rupa rupa. This is called shabda rupa. This is called gandha rupa. This is called rasa rupa. This is called sparsha rupa. And this is called Dhamma Rupa. They are all Rupa. All of this is actually Vipaka. None of this is the external world. These things manifest out of Vipaka, meaning your karma. Rupa Rupa is not the same as light. It's not the same as light. Now we think that light is what we see. But light is not what we see, ladies and gentlemen. Light stops at the back of your eye. It doesn't go any further, does it? So light is not what you see. Seeing is a mental process. The mind is what sees, not the eye. The eye picks up light. The mind is sensitive to sight. So these things you see, color. I mean, practically all we see is color. If we were colorblind, we wouldn't see anything. Then you might say, well, there are colorblind people, but they don't always go bumping into things. So I mean, answer, true. They may not see the vivid color spectrum as you do, but they still see black and white. They see contrast in color. But I'm talking about total blindness, where you can't even see shades of darkness. So if you took a man, right, and assume that we pulled his eye out, sounds a bit gruesome, but this is just to prove the point, that's his eye. There's still an echo, yeah. And then say there's a flower, there's a light source. Light reflects on the object and into the eye, right? Here's the system that is responsible for taking these signals to your brain, at which point it interfaces with the mind, right? Now let's say this was a rose, a red rose. Where does red begin? What do you think? Where does red begin? Does it begin here? But don't we talk about the colors? Like when you look at the sun, is it not yellow? What color is the sun? So when you draw your paintings, you do your art, you know, what color do you draw the sun? It's yellow, right? So there's yellow light from the sun, but we see things in red, green, blue, white, so on. Is that how it works? If the sun is yellow, how come all these things have... Are they all a shade of yellow? Is the sun yellow then? Then why do you always call it yellow? That's because when we were younger, we looked up at the sky, we saw the sun, and then you thought to yourself, the sun's yellow. Not knowing that the sun has no color at all. What color is light then? What color is light? Light has no color. Light is colorless. Color does not begin outside. It does not happen here, 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 it does not even happen at the eye, it does not happen in the optic nerve, it doesn't even happen in the brain. It happens at the interface between the brain and the mind. The fact that you can see color, ladies and gentlemen, is evidence to you that there's a chitta that is born within you. This is perception. The fact that you see color is evidence that you're alive. To be alive means to be able to perceive. There you go. That is what to be alive is. To be able to perceive. The ability to perceive is what being alive is. That's why we don't say this is alive. So when you claim, say someone's dead, when the doctor proclaims someone's dead, when you say someone's dead, that's when they're no longer able to perceive. Now remember, sometimes you might test whether someone's dead, you know, perhaps doctors might do that, let's just go clicking by their ears and see whether they respond, right? Sometimes maybe tap on their body to see whether they respond, call their name out and no response. Just because they don't respond to these things doesn't mean they're dead, because perception happens in six different doors. Perhaps this part is still functioning. So perception happens at this level, this level, this level, this level, this level, as well as at this level. So if there's Dhamma Rupa perceiving, being perceived, then that person's still alive. But their eyes may not be working, the ears may not be working, their nose may not be working. By nose, I don't mean just this part, the whole system, the olfactory system, that may not be working. The taste system may not be working, the touch system may not be working. All of these senses might have already given up, but they may still have thoughts because the mind can generate its own thoughts. But where there is complete termination of perception, at that point we can say that someone's well and truly dead. That's why these things can't die, because they don't perceive anyway. Right? Then, once again, where does red happen? The mind. It's not in the mind. It's wrong to say that dead happens in the mind. Red is a mind. When that mind happens, when that chitta happens, then red happens. That is what it is. It's not like there's a chitta somewhere that perceives red. Perception itself is red. The perception of red itself is a chitta. That is how the Buddha puts it. Aramana vijana lakkhanam chittam. Last week we talked about this. Whether there are just characteristics in this world or whether there are objects that have characteristics. Remember, we had this discussion last week. Why do we call this a pen again? Is it a pen that can write? What is a pen? The ability to write. We give a name. It's not that the pen can write. The ability to write is what we call a pen. Right? It's not that your chair has four legs. Having four legs and a flat surface is what qualifies it to be called a chair. It's wrong to think that a chair has four legs. Because then there's a chair that has... there's a chair and then there are these characteristics. That is not how it works. But our minds constantly tell us that that is how it is. See, say this leaf is what color? Green. So green is a characteristic of this leaf, is the way that we feel, but that's not how it is. This greenness is as much leaf as anything else. Take away the greenness. There's no green here for starters, but there's some chlorophyll, which are the pigments, right? Take away those pigments, take away everything else, take out the other cells in this, and then there's no leaf left. So objects don't have characteristics. All there is are the characteristics. Red again. Where does red begin? Red is the chitta. That's the ultimate result. Okay? Then take another example. Smell. When you smell something, that is evidence that a chitta has just occurred. So the smell of a rose or the smell of a jasmine, do these smells originate in the flower? Do they exist in the outside world and somehow transfer to you? No, they don't. That cannot happen because, remember, you are an electrically wired system. Just like wires cannot carry lights and smells and taste and touch and so on, they can only carry electrical impulses. Your nervous system can only carry electrical impulses because there's a voltage potential. There's a potential there, and that potential is responsible for carrying an electrical impulse. Nothing else can travel in that. Do you see then that what you see may just be a very different picture to what's out there? May just be. All these sights you see, all these colors you see, all these smells and sounds that you hear, none of these things potentially exist in the outside world. The outside world is just colorless, doesn't smell of anything, doesn't sound like anything. This cold, this heat, none of these things are there outside. Roughness, smoothness, or none of these things exist outside. Softness, they don't exist outside. None of the tastes that you enjoy, they exist outside. So the outside world is pretty bland. It's not as exciting as you make it out to be. So why do you want to live in this world? What makes you think that life is so exciting? When none of these things actually exist in the outside world. You are a factory constantly generating colors, smells, sounds, tastes, touch. You're constantly generating them. You are the factory. You are the world that you experience. Just imagine how desperate the mind must be to make this world such a vivid experience, to take nothing and make lots of somethings out of it. Just imagine how desperate the mind must be. This desperation is what keeps you in samsara. Samsara is desperation. So why are you in samsara? Because we are? Come on. Yes. Because we are desperate. We are desperate for uniqueness. We are desperate to identify, to understand. That's why when someone walks in through the door, your heads go. Luckily your head can turn, your neck can turn from this. There's a joint that helps you turn. Just imagine if you couldn't do that. You would like turn your entire body that way. Wouldn't matter who else is in the room or whether Swami Nivasa wants to talk to you, that wouldn't matter. Because when vexation strikes, the need to know strikes, right? You are just that. Yet again, I'm trying to prove to you the point that there is no you there. There's just a process that's going on. Vexation happens. When vexation happens, that is you. You're vexed. Not you are vexed. You is vexed. If the queen was still alive, today would be the day that she would die. Because I'm murdering her language. So, what I mean by that is, it's not that you are there and there's a verb called, what? Desperate. To be desperate. You are by definition desperation. When there is vexation, that is what it is, that's all. The mind is vexation. But we always feel like there is an I here, this is that static existence that we experience. The same reason you say that this is my father's pen, the pen that my father gave me. Despite me removing all these parts and replacing each of these parts with a new part, you still say that this is the pen that my father gave me. Because you stick this in time. You put this on a timeline, and then you say, in the past, it had all the parts that was originally there, but over time those parts changed, must still be the same pen, only the parts have changed. This is a problem. This is why you're attached to individuals. This is why you have friction. Is it not difficult to forgive someone when someone does something to you? No, no one's responding right now. No, Swami Nasa, we are saints. Forgive and forget then and there, Swami Nasa. Really? So why doesn't everyone get a Christmas card then? How come people fall off the list and other people could get added to the list every year? How come not everyone gets a Vesak card or a New Year's card? How come not everyone's invited to the party? This year you invite them, the following year, who knows? It all depends on what the relationship is going to be at that time. Mending broken relationships, forming new ones, breaking ones you don't want to have. This is a process that we go through because we feel that there's a static me here. Now, if you had a friend or have a friend or had a friend from some years ago who did wrong to you, right? If you met them on the street, you may be reminded of whatever it is that they'd done to you. Whatever wrong they'd done to you, you will be reminded of it. But you will also be thinking at that point, this is the person who did that wrong to me. You're not just reminded of the wrongdoing, you also associate that wrongdoing to that individual. There's a question that came through. There's a few questions. I'm going to take one of them now. There's one question to which I'm not going to answer just yet. That will take you a few more months or maybe years before I give you an answer to that. But I'll give you the answer to the one that is relevant to this point that we're discussing right now. It says, Swaminathan, you mentioned that it's a great sin to punish a person as that person is not the same person that existed a few minutes ago. So I'm paraphrasing this. What they're saying is, a sin was committed, a wrongdoing was done to you, and so it's wrong to punish that individual, that's what I said, because when you're about to punish that individual, it's not the same person that committed the offense in the first place, right? If so, should we not have law and order regulating institutions and people executing such law and order in a country? Should we wait until the universe or Vipaka takes its own time to act upon these individuals? That's a good question. Right? So if all it is just Vipaka and we cannot punish the individual because you can't catch them the moment the offense has been done, now it's a new aggregation. Now it's a new manifestation. So should we not punish them and just wait for the universe to take its course? What's the answer to that question? See, it is not down to us to punish individuals, because the universe is always fair. Why do you think someone needs to be punished? So someone comes and slaps you. What do you think you have to do? Slap them in return. Where does this retaliation come from? Why do we think we have to retaliate? Because we feel that's not just, it's not right. How come they did something like, when I'm innocent, I've not done anything wrong, so how come they can do like that? Now you feel that you have to retaliate. That's because you are not prepared to accept a vipaka as a vipaka. The reason that you struggle in these moments, ladies and gentlemen, is because you tend to connect things to one another. These connections get you into a whole lot of trouble. May I ask you a question? If someone borrows some money from you, must they return it to you? No. If someone borrowed some money from you, must they return it to you? Must they? And when they return it, are they returning what they borrowed? Are these two events connected? See, what does your mind say? What does intuition say? Of course, they're returning what they owe me. So the moment they borrowed that money from you, they now owe you something. And once they return it, now they're debt-free. That's how you feel, right? That's wrong. That's not how the universe understands it. Your understanding is completely at odds with how the universe works. And the price you pay for that is, you suffer. If you ever have this doubt, Swaminathan, am I at peace with this universe? Right, if you ever have this problem, am I at peace with this universe? Have I completely attained or earned my Zen? Right? Am I there now? Have I achieved the ultimate realizations? The simple question is this, do you still suffer? If you do, you haven't. One who is at peace with the universe does not suffer because they have zero expectations. Now, please understand what I mean by an expectation. This is an interesting point because we talked about this lending, borrowing business, right? You might think that to have no expectation is an individual who lends some money and then does not expect it to be returned to them. Right? That's, you might think in this transaction, to have no expectation is for there to be an individual who lends some money or gives some money and then not to expect that person to return it to them. Because you try and make your mind up, saying, ah, you know, they may not, but I'm not going to expect it. Because if I expect, I'm going to suffer. You try and make your mind up about it. That's not what this is. To have no expectation is not that. To have no expectation is the realization that that is the end of it. You give it and it does not warrant a return. There is no two sides to it. Typically what we say is, typically what we think, understand the world is, you give something and there is another transaction back towards you. Excuse me. That's how we typically understand the world. If someone borrows something, then it has to be returned to me. But you can claim to be a good person, a generous person, if you think, no, it's okay, you know, they can keep it, you know, it's. I think they need it more than I do, so fair enough, let them keep it. Yes, you're a good person, you're not a great person, when you think like that. The step up from good to great is the realization that that is the end of it. There is no return path for what is given. These are two different stories. I shall not expect. The second one is, there are no grounds to expect. There's no basis for expectation. It is not that they may return it. If they do, I will take it. If not, I won't. In fact, you know, if you truly understand this, folks, when someone brings your money back, say a month later, and say, this is the money I borrowed from you, you should be able to say, no, I never lent you any money. I never lent you any money in the first place. That's the realization I'm talking about. For someone to be able to say that, just imagine the kind of understanding they must have about the world. Another person says, oh, that's very thoughtful of you. How kind of you. Not everyone does that. You know, that's a gentleman that you are. No, thank you very much, but you know, I think you might need it more than I do, so you can keep it. Now, in their mind, there's an expectation, but they're okay. You know, they'll say, let's settle it, it's fine, you can keep it. And they'll walk around or walk home thinking, see how good a person I am? I'm such a good person. I even lent some money and then when they came back to return it, I even said, no, you can keep it, see how good I am? Hark, now hear the angels sing. That's how you feel. But I'm talking about a different matter. I'm talking about a point where you actually question, what? What return? There's no return. You never borrowed any money from me in the first place. Not because of dementia, you can't remember what happened. That could also happen, not because of that. But because you understand that everything is just an event. There are no connections between events. But do you see there's a connection here? Why is this still the pen that my father gave me? Because there's a connection. These connections are not there in the outside world. Ladies and gentlemen, you form, you bridge these connections. You bridge events in your mind. You form these connections because that is the way jati works. I'm giving you example after example to at least walk out of this room knowing that you have fallen victim to jati. Until you realize that there's a problem with you, you're not going to try and come out of it. You may be the best person, best human being in the world, but if you're still with jati, you are still a part of samsara. Remember, greatness is a step up from goodness. To become an arahant, it's not good enough to be good. You have to lift yourself up from goodness to greatness, where you begin to realize that all things are mere events. They have no connection to one another. Remember the candle experiment we did last week? Right, I lit the candle and then I put it out. And then I asked you the question, the candle that has been put out now, is that the same candle that was lit a moment ago? Your words defy your instinct. Your words say, no, Swami, no, so that's not the same candle. But what does your mind say? Of course it's the same candle. What else? There's no other candle that came into this room. It was the same candle that was on the desk. Yeah? See, this disparity, we've got to reconcile this. Well, logic gives you one explanation, but your instinct comes up with another, and therefore there's always this mismatch. That is why I mean, this is the universe and this is you. You are the inverse of the universe. The universe says, no, there's no connection between events, they're just mere events. Whereas you say, no, they're all connected. This happened to me, that happened to him, this will happen to me, that thing happened to her. He borrowed money from me, therefore he must return it. And based on that, we have the banking system. So if this interaction, this you take from me, you return to me, if that thing is, that principle is flawed, what about the banking system? Take it from an ex-banker. What about the entire banking system? It is at odds with the universe. Entirely at odds with the universe. That's why bankers are wealthy. Doesn't mean they're happy. I was a wealthy banker. I wasn't a happy banker. Today I don't have much to my name. Only my robes, arms bowl, and the pen that my father gave me. I'm not wealthy, but I'm happy. Happiness is a function of how close you are to the universe. You know, this unhappiness you feel is the friction that you have with the universe, when you collide with the universe. When I say universe, don't think about the galaxies and the, you know, the Milky Way and Andromeda and the solar system. That's not what I mean by the universe, because that's what we learned at school. Whenever I say the word universe, when I was younger, I say universe, stars come to my mind. The universe. Because that's what I remember watching on Discovery Channel. The universe. Right? Then they had the solar system and the earth and the moon around it. And then zooming in and flying, you know, at light speed into these galaxies and how vivid and colorful they were. Right? That's the picture I have when someone says the word universe, that's what comes to my mind. That is not what I mean here. By universe, I mean universal truth. The truth. The truth. Simple as that. The truth. You only suffer when you're at friction with the truth. Therefore, it's not the truth's fault that you suffer. It's your fault. This is why I try and teach you the truth. I teach you the truth so that you can replace whatever untruths you have learned throughout your life and replace them with the truths. When your mind begins to bear the truths and process the truths and become one with the truth, then as if by magic, suffering will cease. I promise you, suffering ceases. But until you accept the truth, your mind will have its own version of the truth, which is not the truth. This is your own version of the truth. And then you will always try to marry your truth with the universal truth. There will always be disparities. These discrepancies are the places where you feel friction. And that's why you suffer. Anyone here who's never experienced stress? That's a joke, right? Sorry. When you feel stressed, that's when you are at friction with the universe. It's the universe punishing you for not accepting the rules, the phenomena, the laws of the universe. Because if you are part of the universe, then you must abide by the laws of the universe. You must succumb yourself to the universe. What happened when they ate the fruit from the forbidden tree? What did God do? Out of the garden. Right? Until then, there was no such problem. There was just peace. In the same manner. It's the same story, just in different words. The same story. The truth is always the truth, no matter which book you look in. Whether you look at the books, the pages of the Bible, or the pages of the Holy Quran, or the pages of the Tripitaka, or the Bhagavad Gita, you're always going to find the same truth. Only dressed in different words, that's all. It's up to us to make sense of this, these truths. Once you have made sense in one version of the text, all of the rest makes sense. That's why, to me, I see so much similarity between these texts. Hardly any differences at all, really. If it's the unadulterated truth, then it all makes sense because it's all the same message. Only written in different languages, written in different scripts, written in different words, but it's the same truth. Therefore, if you read the Bible, you've read the Quran, you've read the Torah, you've read the Tripitaka. But for that, you have to have first realized the truth. What is the truth? There's only one universe. There may be many books, but there's only one universe. What is that universe? The fact that everything is merely cause and effect. This is all cause and effect. You need to try and make effort to understand that, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I go back to this pen. You know well and truly, because I've just explained to you, here are the parts. These were the original parts, see? This was in here first, it broke, so I threw it away. Then I had the clip, that broke, I threw it away. Then there's the cap, I threw it away. This is the old tube, I threw that away. Now I've replaced it with new ones, but you still think that this is the pen that my father gave me. You know it's not true, but your instinct tells you it must be. Therefore, the sentimental bond that you have with this, the sentimental attachment prevails. Why is the question you need to ask? Why does that happen? And the answer is this. Let's continue this part. Now, so what is a chitta? It is perception of what happens in the world. I was talking about desperation, right? None of these things, colors, smells, tastes, touch, right? None of these things exist in the outside world. In fact, the only things that exist in the outside world are merely vibrations and shapes. So, sound is a mechanical vibration. You need a medium to travel. Whereas light is an electromagnetic radiation. Again, vibration. You just don't need a medium to travel. So these are vibrations. You have a sense organ that is able to detect electromagnetic radiation. You have a sense organ called the ear, and there's an eardrum that is able to detect mechanical vibrations. The remaining three, smell, taste, and touch, only pick up shapes. And when these shapes come into contact with these sensory endings, these nerve endings, they trigger impulses, electrical impulses. That ends up being a chitta. So, quite simply, the fact that you experience sight, sound, smells, taste and touch is evidence that you are alive, and it also means that there are chittas happening within you. When I say the word chitta, if it doesn't make sense to you, just give me a quick show of hands. When I say the word chitta, that makes no sense to you. Okay, good. We're all on the same page then. The chitta is the mind. But the reason I make this distinction between chitta and mind is that mind has this connotation that there's a mind that's always there, right from birth to death. My mind that's always there. But that's not how minds work. This is not a constant mind. It's not like a platform on which things happen. There are individual chittas. That's why I draw it like this. It's like a pulse of energy. Do you remember when we studied electricity at school? We learned it this way. And we call this an alternating current. And then we learned that although these things are always lit, and it gives us the appearance that it's constantly lit, they fluctuate at a rate of, was it 50? Something like that, if my memory serves me right. 50 hertz. Right? So every second, a light bulb switches off and on 50 times. Every second. But it's so rapid that you see it as it's constantly on. So that's how alternating current works. Do you see then that if something happens so fast, you are left with the impression that it's static, it's not dynamic. Your minds work in the same way. It's not like from birth to death, there's one mind that started here somewhere and that's going to end here somewhere. That's not how it works. It's more like this. These are individual chittas. We've talked about some of this before, but there are some new faces in the audience as well, so I'm just doing a bit of a recap. Each of these chittas is in response to one of these things happening. Yeah? Each of these chittas is a response to that. So the moment the eye picks up something, a trigger, and it takes that impulse to the brain, and the brain then interfaces with the mind base, a chitta is born. The moment some shape comes into contact with your nose, and there's a nervous impulse that goes to your brain, and then the mind interface, another chitta is born. That's how in the course of your life, you're able to experience a multitude of things, and not just one thing. So you see things, you hear things, you smell things, you taste things, and this changes so quickly. See, right now you're sat there, you can hear my voice, you can see me, you can feel the flow beneath your feet, right? You can feel the chair pressing against your bottom, and you can feel the ambience in the room. But all of this you can feel almost at once, but it's not actually at once. It's not actually at once. You can only sense one thing at once. So you can imagine how rapidly these chittas must be arising and passing away. It happens at such a blazing speed, it seems like it's just one thing. And it's a constant, fluid experience. But it's not like that. They're very discrete moments. Like a computer, like zeros and ones. That's virtually how your mind works. Chittas. Clear with that, everyone? Any doubts? Fabulous. But that alone does not tell you that this is my father's pen. That alone does not do that. There's more to it than that. And that's what I'm going to start to talk about to you now. Why do you think that this is the pen that my father gave me? Why? Let's see. When one of these happens, now I've just taken one, zoomed in, right? This is now what? A chitta. I'll quote the Buddha again. Arammana, vijanana, lakkhana, chitta. Arammana, vijanana, lakkhanang, chittam is what he says. Vijanane is to perceive. Perception. Take it in the very mundane sense that we understand the word perception. To perceive means to come to awareness, to be conscious. Right? Aramana is an aramuna or an object. Those objects are the ones I drew up here earlier. Rupa, rupa, shabda, rupa, gandha, rupa, rasa, rupa, and so on. These are all objects. Not the physical object. Not these objects. These are also objects, yes. But that's not the object we talk about when we talk about Aramana Vijanana Lakkana Chitta. Aramana Vijanana Lakkana Chitta. These are Pali terms, but you get the idea. These Aramana are not these objects. It's not the flower, which is also an object. But these objects are formed of the four basic elements. You've heard of them. Patavi, Apo, Tejo, Vayu, and so on. So these four basic elements, ladies and gentlemen, the mind has no way of sensing. The mind cannot sense these four basic elements. We know of them because we've heard of them. That's the only reason. You know, we can give a lecture on the whole thing. Patavi is this really hard, solid stuff. We know because the Buddha said so. Not like we've ever sensed it. It's like when we talk about electrons and neutrons and positrons and so on at school. Like we can give lectures on that stuff, right? But have you ever seen one? We've never seen one. But we talk about it. In the same manner, we talk about Patavi, Apo, Tejo, Vayu, which is what these physical objects are made of. Like we know about them, but we don't really. We've just heard of them. Here's what we really know about the world. From our own experience, we know red, we know blue, we know yellow, we know green. These things we know about the world. These are from our own experiences. And these things don't exist in the outside world either. Therefore, to think that this is green is wrong. Put your hand up if that didn't make sense. To think that this is green is wrong. Why is it wrong? Because green does not exist here. Remember, green is a mental experience. It's not a physical aspect or an attribute or a characteristic of an outside world thing. Green is a mental experience. So, when one of these happen, this is green. This is what green looks like. It's funny, green has a shape. What does red look like then? Same. Yellow? Same. But you need to understand what I mean by this. This is not what a chitta looks like. Right? It's not like some kind of object. This is merely a representation of the fact that this is kind of like a pulse of energy. Right? This is a pulse of energy. So the arising and passing away is what I wish to represent here. But green is the experience that you receive when one of these things happen. Okay? Now, how do we get from there to my father's pen? What you see here is really the state of affairs for an arahant. There's something more than this that happens in the minds of us, in our minds. This is called the Aramana Vijana Lakkana Chitta. But we have more than that. We have what we call defilements. The arahants are void of defilements. There's a defiling process. So far I've explained to you the chitta process or the perception process. Do you understand the perception process now? Object, physical object, in front of a sense organ, impulse, brain, interface, chitta. Right? That's the perception process. Now I'm going to talk to you about the defiling process, which does not operate in the mind of the Rahatan Vahanse, or the Buddha, or the Paccheka Buddha. In these three individuals, this process does not operate. In every other chitta, including your pet at home, and the fish in the tank, and the mammoth that used to live back then, and the dinosaurs and the little insects and the ants and the termites and the everything that is living, everything that perceives, this process happens. And what is that process? The process that is called the defiling process, which is the process which is that is based in ignorance. Ignorance of what? Because when you say ignorance, it has to be ignorance of something. This is the ignorance that there are entities in this world. That you are an entity. That's a wrong fact. It's a fact nonetheless, but it's wrong. It's bad knowledge. When you are fed with this view that you are an entity, that in this world these things are all separate entities, now the mind wishes to experience that. So I'm going to go slow with this because I want you to pay close attention and walk with me. Right? This is the dark woods that we seldom walk into. But we can. And we can come out unscathed. Attention. There's an ignorance within you. Now, do you understand that you have a problem first? Right? What is the problem? How do you know you have a problem? Whose pen? Father's pen. That tells you that you have a problem. Don't you get angry? Don't you feel disappointed? Don't you feel jealousy and greed? Don't nod your head to the next one. Lust. Jealous. See? Right? So the fact that you have these emotions tells you that you have a problem. Why are you here on Sunday mornings? Because you don't like it, do you, when you have these emotions? Wouldn't you like to always be positive and only have good feelings, good emotions, like very always generous and always kind and always soft and always gentle? Wouldn't you like to be like that? But you know you're not always like that. Therefore, there's a constant struggle inside of you. You have this picture of perfection. You want to play that part. You want to be the nice guy all the time. But you know that inside you're not always the nice guy. And that makes you very uncomfortable. I know that. How do I know that? I read it in a book somewhere. I didn't fall from the sky, right? I came out of a mother just as you all did, right? And I have been through the same drill. There came a point where I was fed up of how I was feeling within myself. I wanted to be the good guy. I wanted to be the nice guy. But inside of me, there was another battle going on. There was the way I wanted to be, but the way I couldn't be. Because my insights did not agree with what I wanted to be. I had this moral image of what good was like, but my insights didn't agree with that. And I knew I was wrong. I knew it was bad. I knew I hurt myself, but I couldn't do anything about it. So I was desperate. I was looking for an answer. Where's the solution to this problem? I don't like to be angry, but I get angry. And typically we get angry with the people who are closest and dearest to us. Yeah, the people who are willing to take a shot on our behalf, willing to take a bullet on our behalf, and they're the very people that we get angry with. How unfair is that? And yet we promise them all sorts of things, don't we? I love you to the moon and back. All these promises, but one word out of them that we don't agree with, and that's the end of all that love for another 2 days. See, the last thing you have to do on a Friday night is upset your spouse, because then the weekend will be a very, very weekend. Why? Defilements. Defilements. They don't like being like that. They don't, trust me, they don't. Because just as you don't like being like that, they don't like being like that. But where's the pill? Put your hand up if you like to be angry. No one does. Your spouse doesn't either. Trust me. They don't. But why are they? That is what defilements do to them. It's not they who voluntarily become angry. It's what happens to them because of defilements. They are subject to the same cause and effect phenomenon, the same principle as you and I are. So what can you do? You throw something up in the sky, it's going to come back falling down on your head. What can you do? It's not magic, it's mere logic. So if we can come to terms with that, then the first thing we do is we have empathy. Instead of always accusing them for accusing you, that's what typically happens at home. When they accuse you, you accuse them for accusing you. Then they accuse you for accusing them for accusing them for accusing you. Then what happens? Before you know it, it's blame game, tennis. Then all civilization comes to an end, and then it's the rules of the jungle after that. The fittest, survival of the fittest after that. And then the poor children, innocent children, they also have to experience the aftermath. That's what happens in many homes. Many homes. It's not just your home. In every home, there are fights. You think it's just your home because when your neighbors come to you, they always have a smile on their face, right? Holding hands and, you know, arms around each other's necks, right? And they talk to each other in very loving words. All of that in your presence. The moment they go back home, it's like in your home. Everyone steps outside putting their masks on, ladies and gentlemen. So don't be fooled. Here's the thing though, young people in this day and age, you know, they see that uncle and auntie, they're so happy, aren't they? Always in love with each other, just like lovebirds. That's what young people, they look at them and they think, oh, I want to be married. Because they don't see what happens behind closed doors. They don't see what happens once they go home, once they get into the car and the doors are shut. You know what goes on. You know how when you get into the car, right, and maybe 10 kilometers you have to go to get to your destination, before you get out, the wife has to check her makeup again. Because she's upset, she's been crying. She's got to do her makeup again. But when you get out of the car, all's well. And then you get out and you have to hold hands because it's what society expects of you. Right? And he comes around the car and he opens the door for you. But at home, to get into the car, hey, you, in, now, I'm late. But now that you are at someone's place, you have to show that you are the gentleman, and you have to pretend that you are this lovely couple, because that's what people expect from you. Right? Now you have to now show, put up these appearances. Come on, let's be honest. It's the same in every household. Okay, maybe not in yours. Every other household. Right? 9 out of 10, you're the one exception. All this hand-holding, all these pecks on the cheeks, and all this hugging, and all these kisses, and all these lovely words, right? All of that is just mostly a pretense. Because you try to cover up the truth, because it hurts your ego. No one wants to show that they're a failure. That's why. And no wife wants to show the rest of the world that they're a failure. Certainly not to her school friends. And certainly not to her sister. Or to her cousins. That's the worst. Certainly not to the other woman who also tried to marry her man. Like, you now have to, it's a must, you have to pretend that everything is just tickety-boo. So, when they step outside, that's another drama. You don't have to watch telly dramas. Watch the street dramas, I tell you. Watch the street dramas. These are all dramas. But my problem, I only have one concern here. You know, a married couple seeing another married couple like that, it's fine because they know what really happens. But, you know, it's the young people, the teenagers. Like growing up, they think, you know, oh, look at that uncle and auntie, they're so lovely. You know, he just can't get enough of her and she can't get enough of him. Oh, I know that my life is just going to be perfect. I just want to live like the two of them. And then they go and ask him, you know, how's life for you? Oh, it's wonderful. Why? Because that's what they have to say. That's what they have to say. Lie after lie after lie. Never say the bad stuff that goes on. Never talks about the quarrels. Never talks about the fight. No one asks why the auntie's got three fingers on her cheek. That is the slap that she's still recovering from 2 weeks ago. No one asks about that. It's because she has makeup that she can put on her face and pretend like nothing ever happened. You know this is true. But hey, this is how society is supposed to work, right? Because we are all just victims of society. Whatever society says, let's just go do it. Forget Nibbana. What Nibbana? Society wants you to do what? Grow up, get yourself a good education, get yourself into a good job, build a house, start a family, and move up the career ladder. Get married, have some kids. If that marriage doesn't work out, try another. So that's what society wants you to do. In the meantime, earn as much money as you can and spend as much money as you can at the shops and the stores and the supermarkets and all that. People just, you know, so the world just feeds off your labor, that's all. Once again, I have nothing against society, and I know that none of these things will ever change society. Society is what it is. But I have to ask you to question whether this is the drill that you want to play. Are you just a pawn in the game? Is that what you want to be? Just a pawn in the game? That you have to think hard and deep. For, you know, it's each one to yourselves. You really have to think. There are many of you who are playing the wife's role, a good wife's role, because you have to. Not necessarily because you enjoy it, but you have to now. That's the part that you have to play now. You have to just play someone's script. It's been written to you by society. But perhaps you have started to hear some of these truths and you realize, this is not what I want to be. I want to put an end to this suffering. I don't even want to be a woman again. What's all this? Why should I have to go through all this? If there's a greater truth that I can aspire to and I can do it in this lifetime, why? Why do I put myself through all this? But there's a part you have to play because you are a good wife. Then there's another part of the half of this audience who have to be a good husband. Yeah, this is a part you have to play. I mean, it's fine, that's how society works, but then you are just a pawn in society. I see greater potential. To each and every one of you. Oh, how I wish you saw the same potential that I see in you. In my mind, the way I see, through my eyes, each of you is Nibbana waiting to happen. There's an arahant within each and every one of you. A mind that is pure and free from all defilements. Free from the constant strain and stresses of life. Free from disappointments, free from anger, free from jealousy, free from greed, free from lust. Free from dependency. Vimukti is yours for the taking, but you don't. Because society expects you to play a very different role. But for how long, ladies and gentlemen? You live your life, die in this one, be born again somewhere, as a human being, as some other being, and then live your life again, and then again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Each time suffering more or less than the previous time. So, you know, there's enough and more experience in this room, right? There are mothers here, fathers here, professors here, doctors here, engineers here, lawyers here, teachers here, musicians here, artists here, businessmen here, housewives here, house husbands here. That we have the lot. And all of you are still here. What does that tell you? That none of it works. When you go to the garage, don't you see cars of all makes? Think about it, it's a general garage. There are cars of all makes, right? There are the Mercedes, there are the BMWs, there are the Hondas, there are the Hyundais, there are the Toyotas, there are the these and there are the thats. Everything's there in the garage, right? And all makes and all models. What does that tell you about cars? Some of them are cheap to buy, others are very expensive to buy. But they all end up at a garage one day or the other. What does that tell you about cars? No matter how much you pay up front, they all break down. So if someone's ever actually walked into a garage with their eyes open, right? Do you think that they would, if they were in their sane mind, think that there's a particular car that doesn't break down? If some salesperson walked up to you and said, you know, by the way, I have found a car that's the perfect one for you, sir, and it doesn't break down. If you bought that, you fill in the blank. If you bought that, it also starts with C. If you bought that nonsense, right? What does that make you? A fool, doesn't it? Because all cars end up at the garage. See, this is the garage. Some cars are cheap. Other cars are expensive. Some are small cars, others are big cars. Some are cars, others are vans. Some are bicycles meant for two. Others are vans meant for many. And you're all here at the garage. What does that tell you? If that does not speak out to you, I mean, that's a sermon in itself. Come and sit down here and you'll see a sermon here. Because you're sat there, you're looking at me to give you a sermon. If you came and sat down here and looked back at the audience, you can see a sermon. Here's a sermon. All cars of all makes and all models, all types. Two-wheelers, three-wheelers, four-wheelers, ten-wheelers. They're all here at the garage. Meaning, they all break down. So, must not you look for something else? This is that something else. That's why all roads lead here and here they end. I always say, you know, when husbands and wives come up to me and talk to me, I always tell them, be a noble friend to each other. I always say that. Be a noble friend to each other. Perhaps you got married to each other because you expected many other things from each other. But now, if you have realized that you cannot make your wife happy, no matter what you do, because happiness is not something that you can offer her, right? Then give her something that can truly make her happy. If you have realized that you can't make your husband happy, because happiness is not with you. If it were with you, you'd be happy, right? You wouldn't need a husband then. The fact that you are not happy and you need a husband to keep you happy means that you have not found happiness yourself. Then how can you offer it? How can you offer what you don't have? Therefore, this is a false promise. But if you have now realized that this is a false promise, a promise that you made that you could not keep, But now you have discovered that there is a truth that can finally help him and her achieve a happiness that is everlasting, a happiness that you can never give them. Then help them if you truly love them. Most families, most couples are like that, but then there are some that try and pull them back. No. Meh. You know what the Buddha said, right? Everything in moderation. You know, they use the Buddha's words against the Buddha's Dhamma. The audacity that these people have. Everything in moderation. Don't go too much into the Dhamma. Just a little bit enough. Not too much. Like the alcohol you have at home. Not too much, right? Just a little bit. The Buddha's words against his own doctrine. How opportunistic people are. I don't see that as love. Sorry. That is just selfishness. If your husband, your wife, they have figured out that true happiness is not within the marriage, right? And you try and hold them back. I'm sorry to say, but that cannot be love. That has to be love for yourself, not to the other person. Because if they can prove to you that you can no longer keep them happy, because happiness is not something you have to offer, and they have understood and they can explain that to you, not because they've just lost, you know, just gone crazy. But if they can really, truly explain this to you, and you realize that, you know, they're making sense, I can understand what they're saying. I'll also go to one of these Sundays and see what he's talking about. You come along, you say, oh yeah, makes perfect sense. I know I'm not ready, but it seems like, you know, she's figured it out, then I don't want to hold her back because it's wrong. It's ethically, morally wrong. That cannot be love. That's not love, that's just pure selfishness. And then if you have children by that point, then you have to try and encourage your children, because why did you bring children into this world? To offer them what? Education or happiness? Happiness, right? But if all these years you've been giving them something else but happiness, but then you realize, good Lord, this is what true happiness is. It can't be bought at the shop, so no amount of money can bring you happiness. It's not on the other side of the world, so traveling does not bring me happiness. So if you realize that, ladies and gentlemen, then your next thing has to do, as you walk on this path, you try and help your family, the people you claim to love, the people you claim to be, to care so much about. It's wrong to hold them back. How can that be love? But you see that happening in some cases. But then, you know, it's too late. Because now there's a legal bond. And that's what keeps the family together. The legal bond. Is that what you want in marriage? What keeps us together is the certificate. That's a marriage. That's a contract. What keeps your children to you, with you, when they want to go and achieve this noble happiness? What keeps them to you is the fact that they are still under 18 and you haven't given them permission. You call that love? True love has to be where you understand that if someone's happier without me, then you've got to let them be. Otherwise it's not true love. If you realize, if you come to know one day that your spouse, perhaps for many years, tells you that his or her happiness is now with someone else. If you know that he is really going, and she's really going to be happy there, and he has considered all aspects, that they're not just blindly walking into it. And if you can accept that, that is true love. But it's very difficult to do that, because really the true love that you have is the love that you have to yourself, not to others. That's what ego does. Jati is ego. because you are ignorant, because the mind is ignorant, not you are ignorant, but the mind is ignorant. The mind wishes to always experience an identity. That's why you feel you are special. Not special as in somehow better than everyone else. It's not in that sense I mean special. I mean special in the sense that you are an individual, separate from each other. How you feel that you are unique. How you feel that you have to be respected, you have to be recognized. That you have a sense of dignity. Don't you feel like you have to be respected? Like people have to have to show good manners towards you, don't they? Don't you feel that way? When if someone doesn't say sorry, in the event that they do something, even if it's inadvertent, if someone steps on your foot, right, or bumps into you by mistake, what are they supposed to say? Sorry. And if they don't, how does that make you feel? Offended. Why? If that is what was supposed to happen at that time in the universe, and if that is what the universe wants, then that's what's happened. Why does it offend you? It's because of your ego. Because the ego tells you, how dare they not recognize that I'm an individual? I'm a person. I have a sense of dignity. This is the reason you suffer. You see, already you're saying, I should be done this and this should be done to me and people should treat me like this, people aren't treating me like this. All of those expectations is the reason you suffer. If you are the top person in your company and people don't respect you, people don't stand up when you walk into the office, that hurts you. And you'll even go as far as paying them extra to get them to stand up when you walk into the room. I mean, what a joke that is. Some people will hire someone to stand by their front door and salute them as they walk in. They pay them to do that because it makes them feel good. Why, oh why, oh why? You're the smartest person in the room. You've got an IQ of 550. But what's the point? You're a genius. You're a math genius. You're a science genius. You're a physics genius. But when people don't respect you, it hurts you. Right? That's because of your ego. Let me complete this talk by showing you how the ego manifests. Because your awareness and understanding of that is what's going to help you break free of it. Your ego manifests because you don't understand how it manifests. Once again, your ego manifests because you don't understand the mechanism of its manifestation. The mere understanding of its mechanism puts you from mithyaditti to sammaditti. And then, whenever ego manifests within you, you can be conscious of it. And you know, there's my ego, there's the dog, catch it. I have no fear or shame in calling it the dog, because it is what is going to make you a dog one day, if you don't kill the bugger before you die. That's how good human beings sometimes do dog-like things and then they die and end up dogs. That's how we are born into the four great hells, because of our egos. Our egos keep pushing us to do things that are unthinkable. The 10 unmeritorious deeds, the 10 sins, these are committed when the ego is hurt. Trust me, that's when it happens. When your ego is not hurt, you don't do the unmeritorious deeds. It's only when the ego is vexed in some way or the other that you kill, you steal, you lie, you backbite, you slander. All of these things happen then. You indulge in fantasies. Indulge in behaviors that you're not supposed to. When your ego is hurt, because you want something, she's over there, you're here, somehow you're not supposed to have a relationship with her, you're hurt. So now you'll find a way to have that relationship with her. Then it doesn't matter to you that she's someone else's wife or someone else's mother. Doesn't matter. Why? That's when the ego is hurt. This is the one thing that has always been your curse, ladies and gentlemen. Your ego. Now, frankly, I don't know any of your stories. So, these things, I'll just throw them at you. Here are some of the things that you might do. And you think in your own mind, oh yeah, that happened to me once. This happened to me once. I did that once. I did that too many times. And now it's time I need to put a stop to it. There will be some in the audience who have habits that you just can't break out of. You will never do it in public, but when you're back home, when no one's watching you, you know it's bad, you know it's wrong, you know it does no good to you, but you will do it nonetheless. You know that that is not the moment you want to die, because if you died at that moment, then there's no saying where you'll be going. But when your mind asks for it, when it vexes for it, when it begs you for it, how can you stop? Really, no, this chitta that I talked about, it is vulnerable to the ego. Just as an aircraft is hijacked, and the moment it's hijacked, the pilots are vulnerable. And they have to do what the hijackers say. Because their life depends on it. In the same manner, when the chitta is hijacked by the ego, the chitta has no choice after that. It just has to do what the ego says. Therefore, we talk about freedom, don't we? In 1948, what did we all manage to do? Earn our freedom. We were colonized. You are still colonized. What do you mean, were colonized? You still are colonized. Ignorance and attachment are all over the place. Your ego is all over the place. You are still colonized. So what freedom are we talking about? We can fire the gunshots, you know, in honor of our freedom. How many of them? 20? 20? 21? 21. But are you truly free? Freedom is freedom from oneself, not from the British. Not from the Dutch. Not from the Portuguese. Freedom is freedom from oneself. That is what Vimukti is. Freedom from oneself. Look at that man. Free from himself. That is what it is to be a Buddha. Freedom from oneself. The moment you are free from oneself, from yourself, you are free from lust, you are free from greed, you are free from jealousy, you are free from disappointment, you are free from anger. No more grudges, no more resentments, no more tit for tat, none of that, no more retaliation. No more, I'll show him one day, I'll teach him a lesson one day, none of those. You will sleep at peace. You know, the most expensive mattress in the world cannot buy you a good night's rest. Can it? How much is the mattress you have at home? How much is a good mattress these days? I don't know. You tell me. 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 50, going up, 60, more. More? My God! What, do you sleep on clouds? 70? 90? 100? What? You can buy a mattress for a million? Okay. Alright. Right, okay, million. So you buy a mattress for a million. It will be, if it's not today, it will be. At some point, you know, they'll have a, with all these gadgets, all these, you know, sophisticated mattress. They, you know, maybe you won't even have to get up, it'll wake you up, stand you up, right? Maybe it might even make your bed tea for you by the time you wake up. Who knows? Right? And if there's someone sleeping next to you, you don't like them, you just press a button and it just ejects the person. Right? So, I mean, for that, a million is all right, isn't it? I mean, it's worth it. But does that guarantee a good night's sleep? But what do they say in the branding? Buy this mattress for a good night's sleep. Nonsense. That doesn't give you a good night's sleep. At our monastery, some of our monks, unless they have back problems or whatever, they sleep just on the floor. Sometimes it's just a very thin mattress. Just this thing. We call them folders, because you can fold them up and put them to the side. Only because the robe can get dirty otherwise. They have a good night's sleep. They sleep easy, they sleep well. How much for the mattress? Hardly anything at all. How? Money doesn't buy happiness. A good night's sleep cannot be bought, it has to be earned. So don't try to buy a good night's sleep. Earn it. Earn it through your practice. Earn it with your virtues. Earn it with your merits. Earn it by becoming better than you are. Earn it, ladies and gentlemen. Earn a good night's sleep. You know, before you die, sleep one day happy. Just before you die. You know, make that your life's goal. Just sleep one day happy. Try to properly sleep one day. Happy. Without worries about what's going to happen tomorrow and having to worry about, oh, this is going to happen, I have this appointment tomorrow, these people are going to be showing up, the plumbers are coming in, the electrician's going to be out, all these builders, you don't know when they might show up, and the boss wants that report done, right? And then you have to set the alarm, and you set another alarm in case that alarm doesn't wake you up. Right? Seriously, you know, how can you have a good night's sleep? It's virtually impossible. Then you try to buy one. If you air condition your room, can that get you a good night's sleep? What do you put in the health mode? They have these special modes in your air cons, right? Sleep mode. Check your remote when you get back home. If you have an air conditioner at home, it will have like sleep easy mode. Try that and see whether you can sleep easy. You can't buy a good night's sleep. You have to earn it. Ping and Kusal, these are the two ways in which you earn a good night's sleep. You know, I trust me. Seriously, you know, here's the one objective, the one goal I give you. Before you die, live one day happy. You have not experienced happiness yet. For all the years you have been alive, you are yet to experience real happiness. Right now, if I ask you to make a list of the things that bother you, worry you, aggravate you, bring you fears, you'll all have a bunch of things you can come up with. That's why I often say, give me a date and a time when you're going to be happy for sure. No one volunteers. And then I tell you, you give me any date and time, and I will tell you that I will be happy at that time. It's possible because of the Dhamma. But I'm appreciating, I'm praising you for what you're doing here, really. This is not admonishment, this is praise. I'm praising you for the fact that you are putting your life into this journey, giving time into this journey, right? This is what you should have done 20 years ago. I know if you'd started this 20 years ago, many of you would not be here, you'd be with me at the monastery. But this is what you should have done 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. This is what you should have done. This is what I should have done 20 years ago. But somehow this is when our merits decided to mature, isn't it? And now we are here. So do try and be true in your love. And that realization comes when you understand the Dhamma. When you know that the people who you made promises to keep them happy, you can't really do that. But then you realize that there is something that can do that for you and for them. Give them a glimpse of hope. So, back to ignorance. What is this ignorance? This ignorance is bad knowledge. The knowledge, now when I say knowledge, immediately you might feel that knowledge is good. Right? But there's some knowledge that's not good. This is what we call bad knowledge. So ignorant is not nothing. On the contrary, ignorance here is the presence of something that is bad. It's not the absence of all knowledge. That is not what I mean by ignorance here. Because that is also one version of ignorance, right? When you're simply unaware of it totally, that's also ignorance. Now what's behind me right now, I have no idea. But if I thought that there was an elephant behind me, that is also ignorance. So ignorance can come in two forms. Either not knowing anything at all, or knowing the wrong thing. Yes. So here I'm talking about knowing the wrong thing. This is bad knowledge. Bad knowledge that you are an individual. It starts off as a knowledge, as a fact, but a bad fact, a wrong fact. So when that fact is implanted in your mind, the mind now wishes to experience that. But the thing is, this individuality is not something that comes out of the box with a chitta. Because chittas don't bring that. Chittas are merely perceptions. Like I said, red, that's what a chitta is. Green is what a chitta is, not you. Green is what a chitta is, not you. Red is what a chitta is. The smell of a rose is what a chitta is, not you. So where do you come into the picture? Here's what happens then. Where there's ignorance, the chitta now wishes to experience this bad knowledge, the thing that this bad knowledge conveys, which is that there is a me, but because there isn't one, now it goes into a state of vexation. It's like, just imagine when you have an itch in your back, like back here, but you can't reach it. So you try and put your arm around your body, maybe over your shoulder, but you still can't reach. There are certain spots in the back that you can't reach, right? Unless you are very flexible. So what do you have to do? You'll have to ask someone for help, right? So just imagine, this is a situation where the mind wishes to experience something. It's like that itch at the back, but you can't scratch it. Therefore, this is a moment of vexation. And when the mind goes into this state of vexation, now it has to come up with its own solution to it. Because there are no external solutions to this problem. There's nothing in this world that can give you a sense of identity. You have to make it for yourself. You have to cook it up yourself. There's nothing in this world that can give you that. But ignorance says, it's there. Experience says, where? Then ignorance says, it's there. Experience says, where? It says, there. But where? See, now you get agitated. It's like when somebody says, there's something in your teeth. Where? It's there. Done? No, it's still there. Done? No, it's still there. Where? Like you get annoyed. frustrated, right? That frustration happens at the chitta level as well. A very similar frustration happens at the chitta level as well. And out of this frustration, this chitta goes crazy. If you get enough frustration over a period of time, that frustration can lead you to insanity. So that's what happens when the chitta goes insane. This is what the Buddha calls abhisankara. See, the word abhisankara has what happens in it in a nutshell. Abhi means anew. Not anew. Anew as an adjective. Sankara is formation. So then abhisankara is the formation of something anew. The creation of something that did not exist until such time. That's why it's called an abhisankara. So tell me, in Rahatan Vansas, do you find abhisankara? There's no abhisankara in Rahatan Vansas, but there is sankara. Do you recall when we talk about the chitta process, we talk about rupa, vedana, sanya, abhisankara and vijnana? Did we? No, there is no abhisankara there, right? Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana, no abhisankara. That is the chitta process. Because in the chitta process, you don't find abhisankara. It's in the defiling process you find abhisankara. So the defilement process is based in ignorance. The ignorance that you are a self, you are an identity, you are an individual. So when this chitta is now fed with this bad knowledge, what happens? It looks for it, yearns for it, begs for it, pleads for it, vexes for it, and it comes a point where no matter how much it begs for it, it's just not going to happen. Therefore, it goes into an intense state of vexation. And out of that intense sense of state of vexation, lunacy happens. Therefore, to put it very simply, your mind goes crazy. Now you might wonder, what Swami wants? What do you mean my mind goes crazy? I'm not crazy. Look at me, I'm not crazy. That's what you say. No one crazy ever admits that they're crazy. You'll say, look at me, I'm not crazy, I'm fine. I know my left from my right. I know my Monday from my Tuesday. What do you mean I'm crazy? I'm talking at the chitta level. At the chitta level, where there is no possibility for you to sense a sense of self, it's because of your sense of vexation, the chitta goes into this abhisankara mode, and as a result of that, it produces, it fabricates, it generates this delusion of a sense of self. But the point, the thing with delusions, ladies and gentlemen, they look just like the real thing. It's like a dream. What's the worst thing about dreams? What's the worst thing about dreams? That you don't know it's a dream, isn't it? So when you are scared in your dreams, you're dead scared. Because you don't know it's only a dream. And when you see something you like, say, you watched a Hindi film that morning, right, or that afternoon, and in there you saw this nice actor or nice actress. Right, forgive me, I'll be using names that I remember from when I used to watch Hindi films. Maybe they don't even act anymore. So you see Shah Rukh Khan. Is he still act? Yes. Thank you. Give me an actress's name. Aishwarya Rai, does she still act?
Yes.
Thank you. You see Aishwarya and you see Shah Rukh Khan, right? And they play a part, and then you watch the film in the afternoon and you're like, oh, how I wish I could be like that. Such a wonderful story. Kabhi kushi kabhi kam. Now you go to bed at night having watched all that. And then in your dreams, you begin to see your knight in shining armor. You see your princess. And Shah Rukh Khan comes to you and says, "Will you marry me?" So you can't believe, you can't just believe what you just heard. This he wants to marry me. How fortunate I am. But the problem with this is, you don't know that it's a dream. Because if you knew that it was a dream, that you would then know that this is not real. I'm just seeing stuff. This is just a dream. In fact, you can't dream if you know that it was a dream. You can't know that you're dreaming and be dreaming at the same time, right? There are times when you're like sort of in between a state of awake and dream, and you're like, you know that something's not right. But usually the moment you start dreaming, you wake up then. And then there are times when you wake up and you go, why did I wake up? That was such a lovely dream, right? And you try to go back to sleep again. Just so that you can have the same dream, but it doesn't come back. How do I know these things? You know, I wasn't born a monk. That's how I know these things. We both went to the same schools. We both lived in the same world. We've both done the same things, had the same things to eat, and we've both lived very similar lives. We've all done that. So I know what it feels like to be you. The only thing you don't know is what it feels like to be me. That's why I invite you to try it out. See what it feels like to be me. Why do you let me always have the upper hand? I'm the one who knows what it feels like to be you, but you don't know what it feels like to be me. Anyway, so when you're in this dream, you don't know that it's a dream. In the same way, when you're in this state of vexation, you don't know that you're in a state of vexation. And when you start going crazy and you start to experience this sense of self, folks, you don't know that this is now a sense of self. That's why you don't call it a sense of self, you call it myself. When was the last time you got on a stage and said, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to give you a talk about my sense of self." Ever done that? No, we just said what? "I'm going to give you a talk about myself." It never crossed your mind that this was not a real self, but only a sense of self. It's very important that you work out this distinction. What is the difference between a self and a sense of self? One is real, the other is a delusion. Actually, the one that is real is only hypothetical. It's like Santa. Anyone seen Santa? There are people who dress up like Santa, but that's not Santa. Yeah? When I was in the UK and when Christmas was around, in the supermarkets, in the shopping centers, there was always Santa. Right? So you go into one supermarket, Santa's there. You walk into another and Santa's there. You wonder, how is he there in both places if there's only one Santa? Because Santa is not for real, there can be any number of Santas. Because it's not real. He's not real. I mean, it's even wrong to say he. How can you say he's not real? That's an admission that he's a he. He's not he, because he's not real. So Santa's not real. But doesn't stop people from disguising themselves. And then that's a delusion. Rather, it's an illusion. But when you don't recognize an illusion for what it is, that is what we call a delusion. Then what happens here is, your chitta or ignorance, based on ignorance, fabricates a sense of self. That is an illusion. The deluded mind does not recognize that it is a mere illusion. And it takes it for granted. And the sense of self is perceived as a full, intact, complete self. But the really sad fact here is, that self, or the sense of self, is born out of deep vexation. And the moment this chitta has passed away, the next chitta comes along, and the same process has to happen in this one as well. And the same process has to happen in the next one, and the following one, and the next one, and so on. Therefore, in each chitta, remember I drew this line earlier? From birth to death. And I said it's not just one mind, but rather individual chittas. In each of these chittas, you have to fabricate a sense of self. That's how your sense of self remains kind of intact. But the way you define yourself can change, because it's not the same self. Each time you create a different self. See, when you're with your mother, mothers in the room, I ask you, when you're with your mother, who are you? Daughter. When you're with your husband, who are you? Wife. Back with your mother? Daughter. When you're with your daughter, who are you? Mother. How is that? If you are a daughter, you must just be a daughter. How come you're a wife and a sister and a daughter and a mother? How come different environments give you a different sense of self? That's because in each chitta, the new of self has to be fabricated. Therefore, it will be fed whatever the situation is. The situation determines the flavor of this sense of self. The sense of self at its core is the same, but the flavor of that sense of self, that is determined by the situation. So if you're with your mother, in fact, actually you can't ever be with your mother. If the thing that you see in front of you, you think is your mother. So you can look at a picture of your mother and still feel the same. It doesn't have to be your mother. As you take a photo album and you flick through the photos, the pages, you see your mother. Immediately you feel what? You feel daughterish. Right? Turn the page over. And then you see your sister. Now what do you feel? You feel sisterish. And turn it again, and now you see your mother. Daughterish again. And then you see your daughter. Then you feel motherish. How? Because when you see these things, you create in your mind these personas. They don't exist out there. They are all fabricated in your mind. That's why your mind is just a factory constantly producing these identities, these personalities that really don't exist in the outside world. That's why you just can't have a peaceful day. You're constantly working inside. It's a powerhouse inside there. It's just non-stop work. No wonder people are stressed. It's just constantly working inside. You know, you spend your day always trying to gauge and assess the other person. Are they a threat? Are they a friend? Are they a foe? You're always assessing people. You walk on the street, you're always scanning people's faces. Friend, foe, friend, foe, friend, foe, don't know. Watch out. It's like a battleground out there, isn't it? Because you must always assess whether it's a threat to yourself. Because who must you protect all the time? You. I have to be protected at all costs. Therefore, whoever I come across, I must always assess whether it's a friend or foe. Friend or foe? Friend or foe? If it's a don't know, you must find out soon whether it's a friend or foe. You know what? Every word you hear when someone speaks, you always evaluate. Does that hurt me? Does that threaten me? Does that praise me? You're on a constant battle inside. It's tough being you, I tell you. Honestly. See, have a conversation with someone at home. Get home tonight, or you know, on the way back from the sermon. Right? If you are driving home back with your spouse or someone in the family, every word they say, take a moment to be mindful of this, right? Every word they say, you are constantly evaluating. Was that a threat to me? Is that praise? Is that blame? Is that a word of affection or something for affliction? So always checking. Because you've always got your radar out. And if the moment some word comes in, like even if it's even vaguely offensive, right, your guard goes up. Oh, why did you say that? I have to ask another question just to make sure that that's not what they meant. So what did you mean by that? So you have these clarifying questions, right? What did you mean by that? Someone says, what did you mean by that? When I asked you this question, you didn't like give me a proper answer. What did you mean by that? And they say, I'll tell you later. How unsettling that is. This is what happens when you have a sense of self inside. It's never peace. Why do you do this to yourselves? Come on. Come on. Before you die, have a good night's rest. I think you're all old enough to earn this for yourselves now. Right? Childhood's now gone, isn't it? Teenage is now gone. How much time have you got left? Middle age is also now slowly going, gone. Now, what's left? Just a few years, maybe a decade or two. Centuries, huh? Centuries. Let's be honest. That you, by God's good grace, you have another maybe 20 years to get yourself straight, straighten yourself up, find true peace, the gift of having been born human, the gift that awaits you for having been born human. You know, your pet dog at home, no matter how many years he's going to live, he's never going to experience this joy. Because it's just a dog. And you think your dog's having a better life than you do. You do sometimes, don't you? Don't you envy your dog sometimes? I have all this stress at work, you know, problems. I have to feed the dog as well. But look at this dog. You think your dog's having a better life than you do. He's running around and playing, and I give the best food that money can buy. See, I have to clean the kennel as well. I have to wash the thing, and he's just having a good time. No stress, no work pressures. But that dog is never going to come out of this trap. You can. But while you can, you spend your life looking after it. A dog that can never come out of that. If that is good use of time, then okay. If you really think that that is good investment of your time, hard-earned time, time that you earn by doing merit after merit after merit after merit after merit. I don't mind, you know, you spending time looking after humans, but if you have time to spare to look after pets at home, okay. Good for you. Now don't go kick them out. This is theirs now, they're yours now, they're yours. Right? Fair enough. But you must understand the gravity of this, why I'm speaking to you like this. I don't hate animals. I sympathize with them, I can't empathize with them. Because my empathy gets them nowhere. What can I do for them? It's too late for them. But I can try and stop you from becoming an animal. Remember, they were once humans who wasted their time. What are you doing then? This is what I have to ask you. The best that they can get is a meal. Yes, you can give them a loving home, but what do you mean by love? You love your dog when it does things that you want it to do. When it sits, when you say sit. When it stands, when it says stand, when it rolls, when you say roll, right? And it doesn't bark when you don't want it to bark, and it barks when you want it to bark, right? That's when you say you love your dog. You give it a name and you say that name, and it has to come running to you. If it doesn't, no good. Then you try and train it, why? To get it to do what you want it to do. That's love. You really love your dogs. Anyway, I used to have quite a few dogs when I was a layperson. My father was a dog lover. We had Dalmatians and Boxers and all sorts of breeds. So I was very fond of dogs myself. Until I realized that there was a bigger dog inside me. So then I had to work on that dog. The long and short of all this is life is precious. We think that we have time to spare, time to waste. But all of these are seconds that we earned by doing tremendous merits, isn't it? Because this is not a canine second or a feline second you are spending, this is a human second you are spending. Human second in and amongst noble association. Life is very expensive in this part of the world. Life is very expensive. You are consuming lots and lots and lots of merits just by being alive. We talked about this yesterday as well. How when you do merits, always determine and resolve that such merits may help you in the path to Nibbana, and don't go for more than what you need for your survival and for your just a comfortable life. Because the more you spend on your luxuries, the more you spend your merits on such things, and the less that will remain for you to understand the Dhamma. Remember, it's all the same merits. It just depends on what you spend it. Like at the end of the month, you get a check. You've got a budget, how you want to spend it. If you spend it on the luxuries and not pay your bills, at the end of the month they'll kick you out. And they'll confiscate the luxuries. The same can happen with life. These are the real hard facts. I wish I could make it any simpler. I wish I could make it easier on you. I wish I could cut you some slack. But the truth is, it's the same for me as it is for you. I don't get some kind of an extra bonus for having become a monk, and you don't get punished for being a lay person. We both have to take the same paper at the end of the term, and at that paper they give us a mark. If we get a pass mark, we come back to the Sugati world. If we don't, we go into the Dugati worlds. Simple as that. I truly love you all. And that is why I'm translating the truth that I have understood into words that you, I hope, will understand. My love does not need me to take you home with me. That is not the love that I understand. I used to love that way. Anything I loved, I had to take home with me. If I went somewhere, saw something I loved, I had to take it home with me, so I could keep it for myself. But then I realized that is not love, that is just selfishness. True love comes in ensuring that whatever it is you love gets the best, whether it's with you or without you. That's how at some point, this was the two of us, my then wife and I, but we really learned to love each other, truly. Until the Dhamma came into our lives, we didn't know what love meant. And then we let each of us, find true happiness. And that's how we split. That was love. The moment we went our own ways, that was love. Until then was not love. Until then was you scratch my back, I scratch yours. So if you really love yourselves, yourselves, I mean, not someone else. If you truly love yourselves, free yourselves from yourselves. Once again, I'll say this before we conclude. There's enough and more evidence in this room that the paths you have taken in your lives, the journeys you have been on, the adventures that you have been on, none of those lead you to a lasting happiness. That is why you're all here. If that is so, then why must you take another person's journey from here on? Dare I say, none of these people in this room is a role model to you. You don't hate me for that, do you? None of these people in this room is a role model to you. Because each of those lives lived have only ended up in suffering. So how could they be a role model to you? How could anyone in this room be a role model to you? Because they all suffer at the end of the day. Some have more, some have less. Some have just about enough. Still, they all suffer. Some have big houses, some have mansions, some have palaces. Others live in a hut, but they all suffer. Some drive a car, some drive a jet, some drive a bicycle, some walk on their 2 feet. But they all suffer. What's the point then? Some eat well, some eat less. Still, they all suffer. Some have children, some don't have. They all suffer. Some are married, some are not. Some are married twice, thrice, four times, five times. Still, they all suffer. What's the point then? Where's the role model? Where's the role model? I looked for a role model and then I found one. Took the many journeys in life and then I finally realized, no, that's not where happiness was to be found. He had to discover his own philosophy for that. Because he went to many teachers, but he couldn't hear the philosophy of happiness, and then he had to discover it by himself. And the most beautiful part of it is, once he realized it, he didn't keep it to himself. That how many rich people are out there who won't share how they became rich with others. That's the last time they're going to be rich. No, that is how the universe works. Take a gift that the universe gives and keep it to yourself and not give it to someone else, you will never get it back again. It's always like that. You give and you get, you don't keep and get. If you keep it for yourself, you cannot hold it on for very long. That's how the universe works, because none of these things belong to any of us. We think that it does. We think that it does. You think your children belong to you, they don't really. They belong to the universe. You think your arm belongs to you, your head belongs to you, they don't, ladies and gentlemen. It all belongs to the universe. That's why the moment you stop your fight, the universe takes it back. A week after you're dug into the earth, the universe takes you back to where you actually belong. That's how it works. But our sense of self always tells us, no, I'm here, this belongs to me, that belongs to me, she belongs to me, he belongs to me, my children belong to me, my house belongs to me, my car belongs to me, I belong to me. All these belongings happen. And then we all fight with one another to try and protect and preserve what we think belongs to us. That's how there's a war going on right now. Trying to protect what they think belongs to each other. But when two people disagree, now they have to fight. And it doesn't matter if you have to destroy the very thing that you think belongs to you in the process of gaining it. What a joke. Right? You're trying to win over something by first destroying it. And once you've destroyed the living daylights out of it, now you say, no, that's mine. What's there left? Isn't that how sometimes marriage life works as well? Sometimes you beat, it happens in lives, in some people's lives. They beat people into obedience. They beat them up. Then you can beat your wife, but at the end of the day, after you've done all that beating, she's not your wife anymore. She may be obedient, but she's not your wife anymore. People don't understand this stuff. How can they when ignorance blinds them? She's not your wife in her heart. And she's not your wife anymore. If he's not your husband in his heart, then he's not your husband anymore. He's just there for mere convenience. The moment he finds or she finds an escape, that'll be it. Therefore, resort not to the yearnings of your egos, to the demands of your egos. Don't resort to that. There's only one fight that you must all do. There's only one battle that we must all wage, and that is the battle with oneself. Free yourself from that, and you are a free man. Whatever life you have left in front of you, ladies and gentlemen, use it for that. Use it consciously. Use it wisely. Please, on your behalf, I make this request. On your behalf, do it. You can glorify yourself and be a king to the world or a queen to the world, right? But if you don't do what you have to do for yourself, you know, there are many kings who have lived in the past, many queens who have lived in the past. Today, what do? We talk about them when we learn about them for history. That's it. Who does a merit transfer to them? Who does that? No one does. Because they were kings, they were glorified lives, but no, today they're gone. It's history. You will also be history one day. They are the only knowledge of you will be in the registrar's document somewhere, and there'll be a death certificate in your name. That will be the last record of you, and then you will be forgotten with the dunes of time. If you think your children will be always thinking about you and have you in their memories for time and forever, then you have another thing coming. When ignorance strikes, when vexation strikes your children, they will forget you. I know young men, young girls, young boys, particularly young boys, because they come and talk to us all the time. These young children, they need this help, ladies and gentlemen. How young boys, they come to us and they say, "Swami Mohan sir, I can't stay at home anymore." I say, "Why?" "Because I don't know what I might do at home." I say, "Why? What's the problem? Are you feeling suicidal? What's the problem?" No, it's not that, Swami Mohan sir. "But I've been watching too much of this stuff on the internet. And one fine day I clicked on something and that opened up a whole new thing on possibilities. Until then I never saw my mother in that way, but now I do." "But now I do, Swami Mohan sir. I can't get that picture out of my mind. Please help me, Swami Mohan sir. This is the mother who gave birth to me, I know that. This is the mother who fed me, I know that. This is the mother who looked after me, I know that. But today, after I watched those videos, now I just can't get it out of my head. When I see my mother, I have such feelings. What do I do about that now? I can't stay at home anymore because I don't know what I might do." These are real stories. And are you going to tell me that they are bad children? That's why it's happening to them. It's not because they are bad children. Who's there to be bad? This is what happens when vexation strikes. This is what happens when you have to live with your egos. Children aren't bad. Badness takes over them. They're young. They're vulnerable. They're gullible. And they fall into bad association, then. None of these are stories. These are real facts. Sorry, I have to share these with you from time to time. But these are real stories, real things that people come and share with us. You know, sometimes friends joke about these kind of things. Sometimes friends say such things about a friend's mother with the friend. You know, "Your mom," and then he says something. "When I see her," and he says something, thinking it's funny. That leaves an imprint in the child's mind. You don't realize how dangerous this stuff is. Kids don't, because they don't realize the value of parents and they don't realize how dangerous these things are, but they say it, you know, "When I see your mom, machan, I feel like this, I feel like that." What a machan that is. And that message is now planted in that child's mind. The next day they go home and they see their mother. Now they can't help it, but see the mother in through those eyes. Just imagine if you had feelings like that about your parent, how can you live at home anymore? And then they feel they have to compete with their father. Can you imagine that? They feel they have to compete with their father. Despicable, isn't it? It's what's happening. Not happened, it's what's happening. Ego. That's why, finally, I say again, the real true battle is the battle with yourself. Unless you kill your sense of ego, it's only a matter of time, ladies and gentlemen, before you will be compelled to do things that today is not even in your worst imagination. Today it might seem like a nightmare to you to have such thoughts, but one day it will become what is normal to you. Because there is no you to remain wherever you are today. There's no you. It's a constant flux of emotions, constant flux of chittas, constant flux of ignorance and attachment. You're like a soup on the stove, constantly regenerating, constantly changing, constantly in flux. You're only good in this moment. In the next moment, everything can change. So, please do yourselves a favor. Use the time that you have left to work on yourselves. You have been gifted with a human life. Use it wisely. Use it very wisely. This may be the last human life for a very long time. Maybe, just maybe. These are not my words, these are the Buddha's words. I'm just repeating them to you. If you don't believe me, sorry. These are the Buddha's words. If you believe in the Buddha, then you had better believe this. Yeah? Live your life wisely. You have the merits. You have noble association. You have a good association here. You have every support you need. You can do it. I wouldn't be showing you the perils of your negligence if you were not able to do it. But you can, because what's the point of just scaremongering you? There's no point in doing that. I'm telling you the worst side of this because the best side of this I can see within you. That's why I always say, I wish you can love yourself the way I do. If you can love you just a little bit of how much I love you, then you will be doing far more than what you're doing right now with yourselves. That's all I want. You and your Nibbana. On the 12th of April, which is the day before Paranavrutu, there won't be a sermon at this venue. The sermon will be at the monastery. So I recognize it's the 12th of April, which is the day before Paranavrutu. So maybe not everyone will be able to get yourself to the monastery, but if you do, we will have a program there. And if you're not able to, then we will make it, of course, available online to watch after the event. But if you can, do try and get in. We might have something special planned for you. Just might. And then if you come in on that day and we have nothing special planned for you, I'll say, that's what I told you. Don't set your expectations. But on the 12th of April, it's going to be at the monastery. Okay? Thank you for being a wonderful audience. I really do hope that you take these words in the spirit that they're meant. This is not to offend or hurt you or insult you or any of that. I understand how serious this matter is. As a monk, I spend my entire life trying to understand how karma and vipaka works. And when I realize how vulnerable we are, just like a leaf blowing in the wind, just like the flame of a candle waiting to be blown out, right? Then I have to say these things to you. I feel compelled to say these things to you, otherwise what's the point of doing this sermon? I don't want to do this sermon if you don't want to attend Nibbana. I don't want to do a sermon. Ask Guru Hanra whether I like going out and doing sermons. I could travel all over the world. When I spent my life in the UK, I got myself my citizenship there so that I could travel the world. And I did that in my lay life. Ever since I came back and became a monk in Sri Lanka, the only place I went to was Swami's monastery. Before our monks went in there to do their degree there, to be there on their invitation, to make sure that things were as close as they are at home. That's the only place where I've ever been. But there are other Swami Nivasis who travel. Guru Hanra travels. I'm quite happy being at the monastery. I sometimes tell Yane Guru Hanra, Don't ask me to go anywhere. I'll look after the monastery for you. All of these monks, bring many more, I'll look after them. Bring the Mahatmyas, bring the Mahatmyas, bring the children, I will look after all of them. But please just let me be at home. Going out of the monastery is something I like to do. That's the least thing I like to do least. But I do come here because you tell me that you want to attend Nibbana. That's why I don't like to go and do these sermons outside mostly. Because outside, they just want a sermon. So if I can talk myself out of it, I don't go and do those sermons. But sometimes I do, because of an obligation or something. But typically, I don't go and do sermons outside, because most of the time, they just want a sermon. Because it's the Haddavasa Dana, or the Thummasa Dana, or there's a birthday party, or some other thing, they just want a sermon. I'm not here to go doing sermons. I'm a monk. I came into the sasana to attain Nibbana, not go around doing sermons. I've got better things to do with my time. Look after people who really want to get to Nibbana. And most places, you know, there are people who want to do Nibbana, but you know, they are far too engrossed and engraved in their own lives, and there's no hope for them coming out of it. And you know, see, your change has happened over a series of talks, hasn't it? We've been speaking to you for the last 2 years, and that's how this transformation has happened. So doing one talk to a small group, that's not going to do much at all. So that's why these sermons are done, because you tell me that you want to get to Nibbana. Therefore, I really do hope that you understand that anything I say, sometimes it can be a bit stern, but it's only meant to heal, not to hurt. Let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami and Mahasi to deliver the sermon, as well as listening to the sermon and making every effort to comprehend the truths contained within it, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas throughout the world who have sacrificed their lives to protect the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer this message to the Mahanayaka Theras, the Anunayaka Theras, as well as all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in this infinitely long journey of samsara. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the nimrods, gods and deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones who have passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends of ours, as well as individuals who have gone out of the way, out of their way to help us and support us in many ways and forms, and with an abundance of compassion, loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants in this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahatiranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnam midatva dvesha kinnam midatva moha kinnam midatva nibbana parama sukhayam Sukhita-tara-vitmva Nibbana-parana-sukhayan Sukhita-tara-vitmva Mamada-siyaru-loka-siyaru-satmvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansaka Nivan sapaleva Tunvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Sielu loka sielu sattvayoma Nibbana parama sukhayen sukta taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.